everyone. I'm Evelyn.
And I'm Lara. We are the host of Once Upon a Niger podcast, where we take you down history lane as we break down stories about people, places, and events in Nigeria's past and present.
That's right. In every episode, we will take you on a journey of our own discoveries as we feed our curiosity and connect with our heritage. Join us to figure out how the chronicles of the past can help write tomorrow's tale.
Hello, hello. Hello, Evelyn.
Hello, Lara. How are you doing?
I'm good. Welcome. Welcome to another episode.
Another episode of Once Upon a Niger. Glad to be back. Glad to be continuing the conversation.
Yeah.
About Nigeria's history. And we're following on from the last episode, a review of the film 76.
Yeah.
So, yeah, today we're going to chat more about that.
Just delve a bit deeper into the actual events.
Yeah, but before we do that, in this episode we're going to be talking a lot about like head of states and military presidents, etc. So I want to ask you, if you could be president of Nigeria for a day, what would you do?
I'd buy everybody a car. You get a car. I'll be Oprah Winfrey. Give everybody a car. What would I do if I was president for a day in Nigeria? Wow, is a day even enough? But I'll write off the debt of Nigeria.
Can you? No,
you can even do that, can you?
I guess you could just simply refuse. But I mean,
yeah, I'll be like, I didn't sign a contract. I'm not Buhari, you know. If I could be president for a day, I would see what I can do to bring the, to reduce the debts of Nigeria.
Okay.
I'll bring my contract negotiation skills to the table.
Okay.
I will also, I don't even want to say I'm going to eradicate corruption, because that's like, not that's not possible.
That's even the aims of some of the people we'll be talking about.
You know, it's just like, how do you even do that? I don't even think that's something, but what I would also do is I would improve the quality of education in Nigeria. I would improve the quality of education, and I would do that by signing a decree where all the universities and all the schools and educational institutions, they get good funding to build their facilities and whatnot. Yeah. Because I believe that by doing so, actually you deal with half of the problems, because good education hopefully means that you have citizens who are educated enough and aware enough to make sound decisions about their country and what they want, and they're critical enough in their thinking to make their own choices, and nobody's going to be giving their bag of rice at the next election. Then they can actually vote for me to be the full-term president for four years, you know.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah, that's
good. You get a school.
You get a school. You get your debts written off. Hold on, that isn't 24 hours, right? Yeah, so like everybody gets a school.
There's just lots of like presidential decrees.
Yeah, you know, the debts get written off, and all the hospitals, all the doctors get paid their salaries.
Yes, that's an important one.
Yeah.
All the professors and teachers get paid their salaries. No more strike.
Yeah.
No more students waiting 3-4 years until the next class.
Yeah, yeah. And I will increase the minimum wage.
Okay.
Yes. Everybody gets 100,000 naira. The minimum wage is going to become 100,000 naira.
Okay.
Per month.
I hope some of these politicians, they're listening.
Can you hear? See what your fellow Nigerian can do. But yeah. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting though, because we've had many leaders in Nigeria, or even in Africa generally, who's just had ideas of what they would do. And I remember Buhari being like, oh, corruption is going to come, and that was a very bad decision. I was trying corruption.
Trying to imitate our leader.
But I don't though, like, he hasn't really done a great job of eliminating corruption, even though he arrested a few people when he first became president, and not much has been heard of that, but we move.
Yeah, we move. So give us a quick breakdown of the things that we're going to chat about in this episode.
Yeah, so like we mentioned earlier, this episode is a continuation of our last episode where we reviewed the film 76. And 1976 was basically a year in Nigeria that had a significant event where there was a coup d'etat. There was a military coup which took place, I believe it was in February 1976, mm-hmm. where a faction of the armed forces, it was led by Colonel Dimka.
Yeah, Bukar Dimka.
Bukar Dimka. They attempted to overthrow the government of General Murtala Mohammed, and they succeeded in assassinating him and his aide and his driver, I believe it was. So General Murtala Mohammed had taken power from General Yakubu Gowon.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'd taken power from Yakubu Gowon, who had been there from like 1966 up until that point. And Murtala was like a 37 year old man at the time. Unfortunately, he had only been in power for 10 months or even maybe seven. Was it 7 months?
I've seen like 8 months. 9 months.
Something between 7 to 10 months. In between that, he was in power for a relatively short period of time and he was killed. And I think, that moment, that event was very significant, because even till today, you find like quite a few significant monuments have been named after General Murtala Mohammed, one of them being the Murtala Mohammed International Airport. But yeah, so we're going to delve deeper into the events and what unfolded. But yeah, that's what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
The coup that happened, the assassination of Murtala, and what that has meant for Nigeria so far.
Yeah, and I think you raising you know, the figure of Yakubu Gowon is a good place actually for us to start, because when you think about when he came into power, it was in 1966. He was involved in the Biafran War. The war ended in 1970. And you think from his time in 1966 to like 1975, yeah, a lot has changed in Nigeria. So I think it would be good to actually, before we get to 76, actually go back to his time to provide some context as to why 76 coup was so striking at that time. So if we're thinking of, you know, the 60s, that was a time of like revolution, protest, counterculture. That's what that decade was about. And then you go into the 70s, that was like a decade of lots of coups and counter coups. The world was in a very destabilized transitionary period, like globally, I would say. You know, it was dealing with the hangover, literally and figuratively, of the 60s. You know, there's so much change going on. And in the 70s, there were lots of coups, especially in Africa as well. So in like Uganda, Idi Amin had led a coup to take power in 71. Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, he was overthrown in 74. And then Gowon himself in 75 was overthrown by Murtala Mohammed in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a lot of military elites really believing that they know what's best for the country, and not trusting like democratic or civilian rule. And then you're thinking of Nigeria's case, where the Biafran War has left the country devastated and torn apart. Families have just been like destroyed. And obviously there's relief in 1970 when the war does come to an end, but tensions still exist. And you have Gowon, who was the military head of state in 1970. And he's like an interesting figure, because he was a northerner, but he didn't like come from what is, you know, characteristically seen as a typical northerner, because he wasn't Muslim. He didn't come from a Muslim background, and he wasn't like Hausa or Fulani. So he didn't have that background.
Mm-hmm.
So some could argue that he should have been like a better choice as a head of state, because he there's a little less quote-unquote baggage with him, but he brought his own he brought his own frustrations to the country. So the war ended in 1970 and his tenure was increasingly becoming entrenched in corruption, the consolidation of power with the military, just a mismanagement of resources. Even though there was reason to, even though there were some attempts to sort of bring the country together, I'll just highlight a few. So after the war, one of his policies was to give £20 to Biafrans because they had nothing.
Yeah, because at the time, what had happened was, I think we discussed this in the in the previous episode about the Biafra War. Obafemi Awolowo, who I think was the, he was involved with the finances of Nigeria at the time. During the war, the currency had changed. So all the Biafrans who left their money in banks and stuff, their money no longer had value. And as an attempt to kind of, what's the word? Or I guess as an attempt to compensate them for their losses, they were all given 20, was it 20 pounds or 20 naira? And again, regardless of how much they had in the bank before. So say, for example, someone had the equivalent of 1,000 pounds and you're giving them 20 pounds and then somebody else had 10 pounds. So it's it was just not fair. It was not. And obviously this was at the time when a lot of like changes were being made where, for example, he had that policy where all the foreign companies had to give a portion of their share to Nigerians. So the many of the Biafrans couldn't afford to participate or to take part in that policy or to benefit from that policy. So it really created a gap in terms of like, you know, the wealth and the prosperity of the people.
Yeah,
and
especially at a time when this time was a period of like great economic boom around the world and especially for Nigeria because there was a lot of money that was coming from oil. And I think at this time, this was also, you know, there were a lot of like military officials who were benefiting in from the oil and not ensuring that that wealth was like spread across the nation. So you have that aspect where because parts of society are not benefiting from the wealth that is oil, it's increasing like crime and looting and all sorts that, you know, causes the decay of a nation. And then he's already, even by the time of the war, he's already sort of created this effort to also bring more power into the military. So the way the military government was structured, it was what would they call the Supreme Military Council, and it was structured in a federal manner, but the nation was not run like a federation, right? Mm-hmm. Like all important decision-making powers was essentially being made by those who had actually participated in the war or the coup, or whichever coups, and you're taking away power from regions and local people. Mm-hmm. So then your people are becoming more and more frustrated, thinking you're taking more and more power from us. And if this is supposed to be one Nigeria, like give us the power that is rightfully belongs to us. And if you're taking all the power and then the administration is being run by your quote unquote cronies, That's adding to frustration.
It just meant that there was a lot of concentration in one place. There was a lot of concentration of power, of influence, of, you know, a lot of the things involved or required for politics and for a country to run was all concentrated in one place. So one can easily see how the dissatisfaction was slowly working his way through all of the, it was in 9 states or 12 states. He created 12 states, didn't he?
Yes.
And Yakubu Gowon at the time after the Accord Agreement. So yeah, so that's very easy to see. And funny enough, corruption has always been like a featuring beast in all of the coups that has happened. It's like one person say, oh, you're corrupt and I'm going to come into power and I'm going to do this. And then you then become corrupt. And then another person comes and says, oh, but you're corrupt and I'm going to do this. And that's why I feel like corruption has always been that, it's been the playing card for a very long time in Nigeria, even till today.
Sometimes it could even be used as a, I don't want to say scapegoat. I say you're corrupt, you say I'm corrupt. Okay, we're going to stare at each other like Spider-Man in that room. You're corrupt, I'm corrupt.
You're corrupt. We're all corrupt.
We're all corrupt. What next? You know?
Fantastically corrupt. I mean, everybody's, well, I say everybody's corrupt in one way or the other, you know, both in those in government and those and even the ones that are being governed. It is that, I guess, just that pest that everybody wants to get rid of. But it's like you have to look within first. And so this was the case where they were all pointing figures at each other and they were all saying each other was corrupt. And enters Murtala Mohammed, this young, and he himself had been involved in coups. He was involved in the coup, in the first coup of 1966 coup that actually brought Yakubu Gowon into power, where Aguyi Iranzi was the previous head of state.
Yeah,
you know, Murtala Mohammed had been involved and he'd been a participant or key figure in the installing of Yakubu Gowon. And now it's almost like that betrayer that we talked about in the film, where they all kind of start to betray each other and turn on each other. And yeah, so he turned on Yakubu Gowon. And well, I say he turned on him, not like in a personal way, I hope, I don't know, but I guess from a kind of policy, just seeing how the country was being run and thinking I can do a better job.
Yeah, especially after Gowon then, because Gowon during his time has stated that he had actually laid out a plan to go from military rule to civilian rule. And then, so he had laid out this plan in like the early 70s, and then 1974 he just decided, oh, that's not going to happen anymore, I'm going to be here indefinitely.
Who does that remind you of? Does that remind you of somebody called Abacha? Or, you know, the election of the 1990, what was that election when MK Abiola was meant to become the president?
Yeah.
But anyway, so corruption was the play card, and Murtala Mohammed came into power again from another coup. Apparently, it was a bloodless coup. You know,
it was a bloodless coup, and he actually wasn't directly involved in it. But you know, when they named him head of state, he gladly obliged.
he took up the position with gladness, and it was a young man. I guess they were all quite young. When you think of the age of the people who were involved in the running of Nigeria at the time, in comparison to the age of the people we have now, and almost how sometimes it seems like it's impossible for a young person to govern Nigeria, it's like, that's not true, because these people were, in today's, you know, age and time, it's like they were considered young. They were quite young.
But what age is you, though?
Yeah.
What age is you?
The maturity and the exposure that they had, and just making decisions right after Nigeria came out of the British Empire as well. So these people had a lot of strength of mind, and just in terms of their ideologies. And many of them had been foreign educated as well. And I don't know if this plays a part in just like the kind of gusto and the kind of like bravery that they had in many ways to just kind of go for things and to think and to fight for a particular ideology. I think it might be something that was inherited from the kind of education system that they had. And because when I looked into today's politics, it's just lacking. Many of our politicians don't actually have any ideology that they're holding on to, and Nigeria does not really have. We've spoken about this in the first season, where it's like, as a nation, what are the things that we're actually upholding, and you know, what are we fighting for? But anyway, so yeah, Murtala was in power, and his government or his reign or his rule was really characterized by, he was a very strong character, and one of the phrases that was quite commonly acquainted with him was with immediate effect. Mm-hmm. So he put a lot of things and structure in place quite quickly. And one of the things he did was to resign quite a lot of the, was it civilians?
Public
officials.
Yes, public officials.
He sacked them, which...
And to get the scale, we're talking about like, I think it was even maybe up to 100. Am I going too big? 100,000? Also,
it was quite a significant number.
It was a significant number.
Yeah.
And remember, we were thinking, in a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
It's quite drastic and very, very disabling. But sorry, continue.
Yeah, so a lot of things were done with immediate effect. And he just made decisions that some people thought... It was almost like a Marmite kind of situation. Like some people looked at it and thought, yeah, you know, this is exactly the kind of decisive leader that we want. He's strong. He knows what he's doing. He expanded or he increased the number of states from 12 to 19. So he created 7 more states. You know, he had ideologies about... He was a very simple man in terms of his rule. So, for example, he didn't... As opposed to like today or even the rulers before him, where they would have like a convoy and they would have like multiple officials, like just security and all that stuff. He had one car. He only traveled with like, he traveled very light in terms of his team. And I think this was eventually part of his downfall when he was assassinated, because he was just in an unmarked vehicle and there was no way to kind of quickly know that he was who he was, apart from those who were targeting him, obviously. And because I think it was like he stopped at a traffic light and that was when they were able to actually like attack him.
But
he was on his way to, he was leaving, he left his home, which was near the barracks, the dumb barracks in Lagos, and he was on his way to the mosque. Some say he was on his way to the office, but I think the general consensus is that he was on his way to the mosque, and he was with his aide and his driver. His aide was a Yoruba guy called Akin Shewa. I think an interesting fact, actually, is that at the time when Murtala Mohammed was made head of state, General Obasanjo was his deputy, which was quite interesting. And somebody called Danjuma was also quite a notable figure in that regime. But yeah, essentially, you know, he was meant to be this man who had ideologies, who wanted to save Nigeria from the corruption that was slowly eating away at its prosperity and everything. But again, he's one of those people where some people say it's, you know, once a person dies, they might gain this hero title, but when he was alive, there were actually quite a few diverging views and opinions about who he was and what his motives and intentions were.
Actually, as you say that, some of the views of Murtala, I just want to share. A few years ago, some US cables were released that were talking about, that had US officials giving their view of Murtala Mohammed. And one of the quotes is that the leader of the coup against General Yakubu Gowon is an erratic, vainglorious, impetuous, corrupt, vindictive, intelligent, articulate, daring Hausa. And that was a memorandum that was sent by an American ambassador to the Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, in 1975. Additionally, it was said that almost 6 years after the Civil War, Mohammed is probably ushering in a period of coups. As a corrupt Hausa, he automatically attracts Igbo and Yoruba enmity, which he knows and has attempted to reduce by early appointments. As a northerner and a Muslim, he will be expected to consolidate once and for all the leadership role, which his 50 million brothers are certain is theirs. Mohammed will agree, of course, but will seem to Hausas to vacillate as he sings One Nigeria. And it's like, I think this view of him by Americans is... The reason why I find it interesting is because of the point you made earlier, in that many Nigerians thought Mohammed was a great leader, you know, fighting against corruption. And then you have this global international context where you have Americans who are like, no, he's not a good idea.
I'm almost tempted to say I don't believe anything the Americans say, but I guess even when you then look at the things from like Nigerian's perspective as well, because there was meant to have been a massacre in Asaba, which he was quite prolific in that event, and so many people still remember his participation in that Asaba massacre, and they don't forgive him for that. And so he's had they said he lived by the sword, he died by the sword, basically. So he had a history of violence, but then he came into power and tried to kind of try to instill the same rigid, and I guess that the wisdom in power and the wisdom in being a leader is really knowing how to balance and how to, you want to make changes, but you must also understand the, you must understand the temperature of the people. Like, you must understand how things are within the country and try to find a way to bring into play the things that your ideas and ideologies without, not at all cost, basically. But eventually, the funny thing, like I was saying about how corruption is always everybody's play card, is because when Dimka, the guy who led, the colonel who Booker. Led Booker, no, his name is actually Booker Suka Dimka.
Oh, okay. That is true, yes, that is. Yeah.
But Booker Dimka, as it was commonly known, when he led the coup against Mohammed, he had also cited corruption, indecision, arrest and detention without trial, and weakness on the part of Mohammed and maladministration in general as the reason for overthrowing his government. So you're thinking, we're just going round in circles now.
And I think there are a few things there. So I'm curious as to, first of all, though, the statements from the Americans and the statement from Dimka, they're very similar. What was the relationship between the US and their involvement or backing of this, so this coup
exactly.
that happened, right? There's that. And then you have Dimka, that point he made could be justified, because when you think about how quickly Mohammed was dismissing all these public officials, the reality is that that's going to lead to poor governance. All of a sudden, you know, tens of thousands of people working in the administration are just fired. They've left their posts. I mean, in our own daily jobs, the way we're panicking, we're going on annual leave and we have to do handover. And then you want to do that with a government. You want to, what does that handover look like? It's chaos.
Yeah.
It's chaos. It's going to ensue chaos. So it's like that moment, I think there is, you know, it does warrant criticism, I think.
But Dimka himself wasn't like an innocent guy, because he was loyal to Yakubu Gowon, apparently. Mm. And so you think, what is their motive? What was his motive? Because in a way, I'm just very skeptical of the Americans' involvement in anything, because it just brings me right back to the time of MKO Abiola and again their involvement. You know, everybody says, oh, MKO was this guy who was going to save Nigeria and he had ideas and ideologies and things like that. And then the Americans come and say, oh, well, you know, he was this, he was that. And the thing is, everybody's always, no, there's no perfect hero. I think that's the one thing to say. So they probably all had, the same way with Buhari right now, he probably thinks it was the best thing that's happened to Nigeria since whenever. But then, you know, you objectively review and whatnot, you would have some people who would actually say, this man is the best thing that's happened to Nigeria. And then you'd have another good majority say, are you, you know, what planet have you been living on in the last 8 years? So I think trying to decipher the motive and the intentions of the people who are making these statements or who are overthrowing his government, especially the likes of Dimka, knowing his affiliation to or his loyalty to Yakubu Gowon, and it's just a vicious cycle, I feel, like all the things that was going on. But they all felt really justified in it. And apparently General Obasanjo was also meant to have been in, he was meant to have suffered the same fatality as Mohammed, as Murtala Mohammed. He just happened not to, I think his plan had changed on that day, or he had not been there at the right time, and that was how he escaped. But the plan was to kind of wipe out his administration, and because you're always going to have fatalities when one person is targeted, all of their close affiliates and whatnot are going to be targeted as well. So yeah, that was the unfortunate fate of General Murtala Mohammed. But I'm particularly interested in what you think his legacies are, given the short time that he ruled for. Don't want to say govern, because it wasn't a democracy.
I find it difficult to think about what his his legacy is, I just think him as a character is a complex one, because we'll always wonder, had he not been so rash with his overhaul of government, some people, I guess, could argue, like, could he have really cut out corruption? I think that's a lingering, like, question I have. When somebody has been in a position of power and leadership for such a short time, what is one supposed to take from that? Mm-hmm. There is, to me, it doesn't seem there is enough to assess, almost. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what are your views?
I just find it really interesting that, you know, for someone who only was in power for such a short period of time, and he wasn't the first, you know, person to be assassinated or anything, that he had, you know, he's got such a monumental part of Nigeria, like future in Nigeria, named after him. So the airport in the international airport in Lagos is named after him. Also at the time, I mean, his image is on the 20 naira note. So one must bear in mind that at the time when this happened, the 20 naira note was the highest denomination. Now it's not so. But at the time, you know what I mean, inflation. But at the time, you know, that was quite a significant move to have him on the 20 naira note. And so when you contrast, you think the kind of person that kind of honour is given to surely must be somebody that the country, to a large extent,
deems worthy
of it. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And so when you have this narrative of him being vicious and him being all these negative things that the Americans say, and then you compare that to the actual way that Nigeria has chosen to honor him, you think surely there's got to be an element of
truth
in a way, or at least, yeah, the reality must have been somewhat...
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think what I'm hearing from you is that it's not right for us to ignore the possibility that actually maybe he was, quote-unquote, good, you know, in his position because of what he at least represented, or what his intentions and his aims were. And that definitely resonates with me, because when you think about his predecessor, right, his predecessor was around for like nine or so years, and then Muhammad was gone like that.
Yeah.
And I find that so fascinating, because it's like, so for the 9 years, we all knew that this corruption was building up, was getting entrenched. The Americans and the British, that did they not see that that corruption? But now Muhammad comes into the picture, and Muhammad gutting out the government with all the previous cronies from my predecessor.
Yeah.
And then 9 months later, he's dead.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
for me, that's very typical of like where you've got interventions of international communities who are oftentimes do not have the interest of the development of a country at heart. So like, I'm reminded of Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso. And again, I don't know, I can't compare them in much similarity, but I think they're, when I think of him, I do think of Thomas Sankara in the sense that he also had strong ideologies for eliminating corruption, you know, for how he thinks the economy of the country was going to be progressive, and, you know, just kind of like localizing things and making. But it was also the kind of character that the almost with the immediate effect with which he also enacted a lot of things, and that led to his own assassination as well by a very close ally. So it's just when you have, and I think this has been in a way, I think in Africa, one of the things we've suffered is really where we've had supposed saviors, but their lives have been cut short really quickly. And oftentimes all we have is just the memory of what could have been, what might have been, but what never really was. So we'll never know. So we'll never know what Murtala Muhammad could have achieved. We'll never know what MK Abiola would have achieved if he, but we can only speak of the intentions, what was known at the time. And yeah, I guess it's up to Nigeria to really kind of do justice and make it known. But yeah.
This figure is a really, important one, a very interesting one. And yeah, his legacy poses interesting questions for Nigeria today. So I've really enjoyed actually delving deeper. Yeah, this moment in our history.
Yeah, most definitely. And I hope the listeners have enjoyed listening as well. So if you have, drop us a comment. We're on all of your favorite platforms. Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can catch us there. And until next time.
Until next time.
Cheers.
Bye.
So guys, thank you for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it and learnt a thing or two.
Yep, you can find our episodes on Spotify, YouTube, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to keep up with us in between episodes, you can follow us on Instagram at Once Upon a Niger.
You can also find links to some further reading and information about the episode's topic in the show notes. If you want to encourage, collaborate, or as I like to say, support the ministry, drop us an email at onceuponaniger@gmail.com. Bye for now.
Bye.